Well, here we are.
It is time, Simba.
If you understand that reference, you might be about the age where we should be working together. It's possible. But it is now one of 3 times a year that I'm accepting clients for my freedom framework, overcoming food sensitivities and increasing energy without unnecessary restriction. My goal for my one-on-one clients is to take them through frameworks and explore tools for achieving 50, 80, 90% of their goals in just a few months and show them how to continue to heal on their own so they don't need me anymore. Honestly, I think we're doing great one-on-one work here, helping women that would otherwise be falling through the cracks, thinking that they're just aging, that they're just moms, that they just, and it may be true that they just have stress, when really those stress hormones and their other core systems just really need some serious support and some serious love to serve them for years to come without symptoms. So if you'd like to clear inflammation, eczema, food sensitivities, or improve energy and brain clarity, I'd love to chat with you. You can book a call with me at kristabigler.com/FSS, kristabigler.com/FSS, and that link will be in the show notes.
So during the holiday season, to give us a little bit of a break, and also because I think this is cool and fun, sometimes people tell me, "Wow, I really love this podcast, but you've got so much stuff," that I wanted to do an encore or a replay of some of our most popular episodes over the next month. And if they are the most popular episodes, there's probably a reason. So this first one originally aired in April of 2018 with Karan Krishnan, and this was the beginning of my professional crush on Karan Krishnan. So I am a how stuff works kind of person. I love the behind the scenes stuff. So let me tell you what's happened since this episode aired. First of all, Karan wowed me with his knowledge. He's incredible at doing that. He's an amazing educator. And his background is that he was a microbiologist creating products for other companies. He found spores. I think he's going to talk about that in the episode, so I won't bore you with that. But since then, he created his own company. You'll probably hear about that in the episode too. I actually did some really short-term contracting for the company because I loved them so much, and they were growing so much so fast that it was usually things are quite disorganized behind the scenes. I've seen this many times. And so that did not last too long, yet I still love Sprobiotics, and Karan is no longer with the company anymore. Actually, I don't even know what he's doing. He's probably just taking a break. I'm not exactly sure what he's doing right now, but he and his partner, Tom, they exited the company. It was sold to a very large supplement company out of Europe called Novozymes. Yet, I think the information here is still valid, still stands. I think Sprobiotics were really revolutionary to my practice when I added them about 5 years ago. I hope you enjoy this episode from April of 2018. Forget everything you think you know about probiotics. I want to take a quick minute to tell you a couple things that I'm really excited about that are happening right now. First, something that weighs really heavy on my heart is burnout potential. Everyone is so good at go, 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 glue truck technology that we often just need to stop, rest, and reset. So I'm thrilled to announce Reset in Sedona, a restorative wellness retreat for women craving good food and adventure. Now, I have a lot of feelings about how retreats are non-negotiable, and I've been practicing for this for years, attending and hosting other private retreats. So if an intentional reset to fill your cup sounds good to you, you can head to the show notes to find the link for Reset in Sedona or go to kristabigler.com/resetinsedona. And the second is that I'm currently taking intro calls for clients to start in the new year. I work with people that feel like they're doing everything right in health, but still have food sensitivities, subpar energy and mental focus, gut issues, and eczema. I help them with a sustainable way to eliminate symptoms and feel their best using testing, synergistic nutrient repletion, and supporting several major systems in the body for balance. You can go over to kristabigler.com/FSS. Both links will be in the show notes. And now back to the show. All right, today on the Less Stress Life, I'm so excited to be geeking out today with Karan Krishnan. He is the brains at Microbiome Labs, which if you haven't heard about today, I'm sure you'll be researching them like crazy after you listen to this episode. So he's a research microbiologist, has been involved in the dietary supplement and nutrition market for the last 16 years. He comes from a lot of research as his background. He spent lots of years in R&D research and development in molecular medicine, microbiology at the University of Iowa. He regularly lectures on the human microbiome at health and medical conferences and is sought after for national and satellite radio expert talks. So he's this chief science officer at Microbiome Labs, which owns Megaspore and a vitamin K2 supplement, et cetera. We might let him chat about that here at the end. I feel like we're going to get on all kinds of tangents. And he's the advisor to seven other companies, I believe, and he can correct me. So welcome, Karan.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. So good to be here with you.
Yeah, I'm very excited to be talking bacteria. So you have the ability to really capture your audience when you talk the numbers about the gut. And I think that regardless of the fact that we may know, if you're listening, about all the impact with the gut-brain connection, how it affects so many, it affects everything at the core, right? So you and I may be living this topic in very different ways, but it's fun to give the lip service to the magnitude of everything that's going on. So do you want to just give us a little bit of background about the gut and why we should all care about it so much?
Yeah, and that I think is extremely important. And it also brings up the point that we're living in a very exciting age, because all of these years of the decades of medical research and study and all that have basically been looking at what we consider to be less than 10% of what a human actually is. And to explain that, it's important to note that there's about 10 trillion cells that make up the entire human body. That's a lot of cells. 10 trillion is a number most people almost never come across on a regular basis. And that's 10 trillion human cells. But compare that to over 100 trillion bacteria cells that live in and on our body. And we used to think of any bacteria that we find in and on our body as accidental travelers. You know, we picked them up by meeting somebody. We picked them up by getting dirty somehow. And then they hopped on our vehicle of a body and the accidental travelers. But we now come to know that we're in fact a lot more bacteria than we are human in many different ways. So the cell count, we have 10 times more bacteria cells in and on our body than human cells. And then the part that's actually even more fascinating is our genetics. We've all been talking about genetics and our genes and our DNA for so long. We know and believe that our DNA is what dictates everything about us, everything that we can see, hair color, eye color, the way your face looks, your height, and so on. And also the DNA dictates genetic risk for diseases and how healthy you are and so on. The problem is when they sequenced the human genome, what they found was around 22 to 24,000 working genes in the chromosomes. And that sounds like a lot, but then you compare it to a rice plant. A rice plant has over 40,000 working genes. Or if you compare it to an earthworm, a very unsophisticated organism, has over 40,000 working genes. So we are half as cool as a rice plant or an earthworm, right? And then the question is, how is it with our very limited number of genes, can we do all the things that we do, that we are cognitive organisms, that we have this capability of creating this world and moving up to the top of the food chain and the evolutionary ladder? And as it turns out, it's because we have over 3.5 million bacterial genes in our body. So in fact, we use over 3 million pieces of bacteria DNA on a regular basis to conduct our functions. So what makes us human is actually dictated by the bacterial DNA that's found in our system. And that accounts for over 90% of our day-to-day function. So their role in our well-being and in our bodies and in making us human cannot be overstated. And we knew nothing about this until about 5 weeks ago.
Yeah, that's the crazy part. So at no point can we ever give too much attention to the bacteria. So we're really not that mature chromosomal growth worms and rice plants are more chromosomally diverse, but we're more, the thing that sets us apart is bacteria, and that's how we function.
Totally. And it brings up a cool term that people can use at the next cocktail party to seem like a super nerd. Holobiome. So holobiome is defined as a superorganism, right? So when we looked at evolutionary science to see, okay, how did humans, who are relatively incapable of stuff, when you look at our physical characteristics, right, there are many animals out there that are far stronger than we are, that are more adapted to living in the outside world because they have thick sides or they have fur to protect their body and their skin. And they're stronger, they can climb, they can run faster, all of these things that outdo us. How is it that the human, the Homo sapien, has actually surpassed all of the animals and gone to the very top of the evolutionary ladder? One of the reasons is because we have been fortunate enough to allow the cohabitation of thousands and thousands of other organisms. So holobiome means superorganism. So what we are essentially is a walking, talking rainforest. We are an ecosystem that is put together by thousands of different species that have to work together in concert in order to perpetuate the health and wellness of the whole. You know, we always have this rule, the human body is all these organ systems connected by nerves and vessels, and our brain controls everything. As it turns out, that's not really true. What we really are is a walking, talking ecosystem. And the amazing thing about that view is we now understand disease progression differently. Now we can go, we can look at virtually every chronic disease, things that are extremely scary like cancer, all the way to things that are benign but really annoying like acne, as having kind of similar progress. If you mess up some part of that ecosystem, it throws off the entire whole. And that's really what a disease is. A disease is a messing up of some component of this complex ecosystem that throws off the balance of the whole organism.
I love how we can always dial back and just embrace that whole keep it simple, stupid thing. Because really, we do have core concepts. And if we start at that, then things feel or seem less complicated. We can go down all kinds of rabbit holes from that, but we have to stay true to the core.
Absolutely. And then the core is, to me, where real change can happen. If we keep going back to the core and we keep things simple and we try not to complicate things too much, and that's where we tend to see the most change, just bringing back to the basics. And it becomes really easy in this world of really advanced scientific discovery and abilities to study things to really get away from that core and really focus in on one small little component in great detail and getting the baseline message. And that's keeping it simple and going back to our basics.
So tell us a little bit. So we know that we're a walking, talking ecosystem, rainforest, but where do we get this microbiota?
Yeah, and that's how important mammoths to all of us. We all have this special bond with our moms for the most part. And the one of the most important things that mom does for us is she gives us our ecosystem. In large part, you end up with this ecosystem that's completely unique to you. That's another important thing to mention is that no two individuals in the world have the same exact ecosystem. They're even identical twins who are born of the same mother, who have 100% the same genetics, can have up to a 30% change difference in their ecosystem. So that's the most unique thing about us. So during the birthing process, passing through the vaginal canal, we get a huge inoculum from mom. And in fact, her vaginal bacteria have changed at that point to add new species that typically aren't there when she's not pregnant or not having a baby. And so her vaginal canal becomes this amazing bio soup, if you will, of really important bacteria that end up inoculating the baby. Now, that inoculum, as you pass through, ends up getting into the baby's mouth and ears and nose and virtually every other orifice, and of course the skin as well. Now, the other part of it is through fecal matter. One of the most common things that happens during natural childbirth is mom defecates. And that defecation is all right there. The exit for defecation and the exit for the baby are inches apart. And so it's actually perfectly normal and also very healthy for the baby to get exposed to mom's fecal matter. And that's another big source of bacteria. So between the vaginal canal and the fecal matter, the baby gets a huge inoculum initially. And then after that, it's close interaction with mom and dad, and then breast milk. Breast milk is probably one of the most important things and you like to do for a baby. And we can elaborate on that as we go along.
So I think about having babies. I don't know if you've had babies. And I remember having this conversation with the OB staff about, I don't know why God put the anus and the vagina so close together because it seems a little backwards. But now we're having a conversation about our creator knowing what he's doing, putting those two pieces together, I think. And so now moms can go brag at mom groups that, yes, I did crap on the table during birth because we'd like to keep things entertaining around here.
Exactly. And that is life-giving poop. It's so important. For example, one of the most important bacteria that the baby needs in its initial part of life, so especially in the first 6 months, having adequate amounts of this bacteria is absolutely critical, and that's bifidobacteria. And bifidobacteria is found in large amounts in poop. And the reason for that is Bifidobacteria in your intestines, in yours, in mine, in all our intestines, are concentrated at the distal end of the intestine, basically in the distal part of the colon. So the farthest part of the colon, right by the anus, right by when poop comes out. So when man desiccates, what is concentrated in that fecal matter is Bifidobacteria. And if the baby doesn't get enough exposure to that Bifidobacteria, it's been shown to create a significant amount of issues within the baby. For example, immune dysfunctions, dramatically increases risk for asthma, allergies, eczema, psoriasis. Also, it can increase risk for behavioral disorders as well, including autism spectrum disorders. All of that from not getting enough poop.
Yeah, that's all we needed. That is our whole life simplified. Poop on your baby.
More. Just cave plant babies. As you imagine, so you think about our ancestral babies. We now have these ultra-sterile hospital environments. But for millions of years, mom has been squatting and essentially pushing the baby out onto the ground, onto the dirt. And at the same time, as she's squatting and pushing the baby out, poop's coming out. And the baby's, the first things the baby comes in contact with in the open world is dirt and poop. And that's how our system evolved. And in fact, when you start looking at and when you consider that and look at the types of bacteria involved in dirt and the types of bacteria involved in poops, the two most important genres of bacteria that the baby needs early on in life are the bacteria found in poop and the bacteria found in dirt, like the bacillus spores. One study published showed that the bacillus spores works alongside with mom's natural bacteria to actually build the baby's immune system within the gut. So that dirt-poop combination is absolutely critical. And for the most part, in childbirth today, we've put barrier, of course, against the dirt. We no longer deliver babies in the environment, but we also start to put barriers against the exposure to fecal matter. And the biggest frame of that is C-section.
Mm-hmm. How do you suggest that parents overcome the disadvantages of having a C-section or even antibiotics or a traumatic birth?
Well, and the good thing is, the good news of that is that you can overcome some of it. So it depends on the scenario. If the C-section is elective, which people still do today, there was a big trend of it in the 90s where people were scheduling the birth because it's so much more convenient. That's really unfortunate. And if you're choosing to do that, or if your C-section is required medically, there's, of course, many conditions in where C-section is required. So people shouldn't feel bad if they ended up having C-section. If they needed it medically, that's perfectly reasonable. But if you're having a C-section and you're at the hospital or you're going to be at the hospital, you can talk to your doctor about doing an impact swab. So, for example, if mom is going into the OR, what they can do is take sterile gauze and put it in the vaginal canal. And then once the baby is removed from the incision, the first thing that should happen is that sterile gauze should be removed from mom's vaginal canal and wipe the baby down with the gauze. Wipe all over the face and skin and head and all that. That seems to negate a lot of the negative effects of C-section, not getting that appropriate exposure. And that was extensive studies done at NYU by two microbiologists and I think OBGYNs. So we showed that if you can swab the baby with mom's vaginal juices right off the bat, right as soon as the baby's pulled out, it can negate a lot of the effect. The other thing that can be done is giving the baby the right kind of probiotics. As I mentioned, the bacteria, the good bacteria found in dirt that our humans have been exposed to for millions of years, plays a really critical role in designing the initial part of the gut and the microbiome. So those spore-based probiotics. And then the third part is breastfeeding. Breast milk contains 600 to 800 different species of really beneficial bacteria. It also contains 200 different types of prebiotics that the baby can digest or food that's there purely to seed the good bacteria within the gut. So if you're ending up having a C-section or antibiotic use or any of that during the birthing process, please breastfeed the baby as much as you can and for as long as you can.
So what are your thoughts on use of supplemental colostrum, even later on in life? So sometimes that's considered a gut healing. I mention it to parents. So I work with a lot of eczema kids. Okay. Often I'm seeing a history, at least in the really severe cases, I'm almost always seeing a history of a traumatic birth, possibly antibiotics of birth. They almost always have jaundice, which is really interesting, like almost 100%, very fascinating. But we talk through supporting internal organs and internal systems in the work that we do together. And I mentioned colostrum as a potential that some people use, and not a lot of people have gone on to use that. But what do you think about supplemental colostrum?
So I use colostrum. I travel a lot. I fly. This year, I've flown over 250,000 miles. I put a lot of stress on my immune system, on my body in general, from all of that travel and all of that presenting and all. So I use it quite a bit. I've also used it with my kids. It depends on the company also. There's good, clean colostrum. There are immunoglobulins that have been extracted from colostrum that can be highly effective. What I tend to find, and when you start looking at the research behind colostrum, is they've done a lot of good studies showing the modulation of the immune response in the intestinal tract by colostrum. So colostrum becomes a really important component to me. If you have an unhealthy gut, if you have a dysbiotic gut, if you have a leaky gut, for example, if you have inflammatory conditions, which, as you mentioned, the eczema, psoriasis, as indicators of inflammatory conditions, all of those things, I think, can be helped quite a bit with the use of colostrums. They're basically immunoglobulins that help bind the toxins within the gut, and in particular, bacterial toxins, and then also modulate the immune response in the gut to lower the amount of inflammation that's occurring in the lining of the gut. And it does the job well to do that.
I think one thing that I want to make sure I mention from what you just said is that this is a key point that a lot of us disregard or forget. You were talking about how you put your body under stress voluntarily by the work that you do, but you're always supporting yourself. And so I think it's important for people to recognize where we're deficient and stop and say, whoa, I need to just give myself some support, even if it's short term because of this or this reason. So I think that's a valid point to stop and put a flag on.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's really important that you did that, because the other thing is, when we understand the disease process in the new light that we have, in view of the microbiome, in view of human as an ecological system, one of the things we start to understand is that typically disease starts way, way before it ever shows up as something that's diagnosable. So, for example, if you have an autoimmune condition like Hashimoto's, the process that has led to that diagnosable state of the disease probably started 15 years before that, even 10 years before that, sometimes much longer than that. And it's a slow disruption of the ecology, and your body's always trying to adapt and fix it, and then you continue to disrupt it, and the body's trying to fight this battle, but eventually the disruption wins out, and then you get this diagnosable disease. So even though you're feeling fine at the moment, you see you're putting your body through stresses, if you know that you're not sleeping as much as you should be, you're not eating as in the way you should be, you're not getting enough exercise, you're not being mindful enough, you're not centering yourself on a daily basis, life is stressful, you still feel fine, but all of those things are causing that slow ecological disruption that will show up as a disease 3 years, 5 years, 10 years from now. So people are very acute. You know, they're like, they don't really think about stuff until it happens. And we want to make sure that we keep thinking of about our body as this ecology, and we know all of the things that disrupt the ecology. So as we're doing those things, let's also do things to keep resetting the ecology.
I love that. And you mentioned something that reminded me of another point I saw you speak about somewhere else. And so I just want to diverge for a quick second from childbirth before we move on in the life cycle to talk about one other big stressor that's becoming a big, this is an interesting topic. So we're talking about spore-based and things that come from the environment. That's our main message today. But there's other environmental stressors, and there's some things that are really seeming to really gut the system, really gut our GI system. And that is potentially some of the environmental chemicals that we're dealing with that are regularly in our dirt. Can you speak for just a second about kind of the impact of glyphosate and what that looks like, just from a purely scientific and an evidence perspective?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, there are this awesome gathering of data that has plotted the use of glyphosate in certain regions within the country. And the data shows when they start using glyphosate, and as they increase the use of glyphosate, they plot it in parallel to the increase in prevalence of numerous diseases. So things like autism spectrum disorders, obesity, cancers, Parkinson's, diabetes, Alzheimer's, they plot it right next to the plot of the increased use of glyphosate, and they are absolutely parallel. And this is 20 years worth of data. And so it's absolutely clear that there is, at the least, a correlative effect of the exposure to glyphosate and the increased risk of these diseases. Now, all that in mind, the FDA and the companies that produce and use glyphosate will tell you all day long that it's safe, and it's been tested to be safe in humans. Hence, the FDA has approved it, or the USDA has approved it for use. Now, the reason why they say it's safe is where the science breaks down. So glyphosate is a compound that interferes with a biochemical pathway called the shikimate pathway. It's basically a biochemical process that leads to the production of energy and so on. Now, the shikimate pathway is a pathway that is found in plants. And when you disrupt that pathway in plants, it kills the plant. So the rationale there is that human cells don't use the shikimate pathway. And so because we don't use the shikimate pathway, this chemical that interferes with that pathway is completely harmless to us. That's the rationale behind what they pronounce to be the safety of glyphosate. The problem is the bacteria in our gut utilize that same pathway. And when the bacteria utilize that same pathway, the killing effect that it has on weeds and other plants, that same killing effect occurs in our gut. So it's basically consuming large amounts of antibiotics every single day through your food. And it's destroying our gut microbiome. And now we know that when we disrupt our gut microbiome, it causes disease. It doesn't take a major scientific leap to put those two things together. That what glyphosate is actually doing is it's destroying our gut microbiome. And because of that, it's causing a huge increase in risk for all of these diseases. So essentially, your environment which is supposed to be helping your microbiome. We're supposed to be getting exposure to all of these good bacteria within the environment that enhance and protect the microbiome. Instead, we're getting exposure to these chemicals that are destroying the microbiome on a daily basis. It's so pervasive that there are cases now that have been published where they can find glyphosate in the cord blood or the umbilical cords in newborn babies.
Right.
It's in there. It's getting in everywhere. And your neighbor or yourself might be using the weed killers in your yards. And then the thing is, once it gets into the plant, it can't be washed out. So even if you take your bio vegetables, you soak them, you wash them, you're still not going to get rid of glyphosate because that shit goes into the cell structure of the plants. And so when you consume those plants, then your bacteria get exposed to it.
I wish we had time to go down that path because I have some funny stories, but we'll save them for later. Yeah, I don't think there's any escape from that. And it's more, this just goes back to that other flag point of when we know we're under stress, then we should really work on supporting that in different ways and really increasing our knowledge. And how do we support that? How do we always be working on improving our core health in different ways? And that kind of goes back to that whole topic.
Yeah, absolutely. Let me mention something about stress. I want to give people two visuals so that they really understand what stress is doing. We all know that stress is bad for us. We've always heard that stress can make you sick and stress is bad for your health. But people really don't appreciate what stress is actually doing. Let me give you two biochemical things that stress actually does. When we increase the amount of stress hormones that we produce in the body, so things like norepinephrine, epinephrine, the cortisol and all those other hormones, one of the things that it's doing is it's actually increasing the virulence or the ability to infect of many of the organisms that are laying dormant within our body. So viruses, we all have viruses, bacteria, amoebas, all of these things within our body that are pathogenic, but are just sitting around and not really causing problems until there's an opportunistic time for them to do. One of the biggest drivers of those opportunistic times is the increase in stress hormones. So stress hormones in the body totally change your microbiome and favor the growth of pathogenic and infective organisms. So that's one mechanism by where stress really destroys the body and has such a negative impact. The second one is stress causes leaky gut. And we can talk more details about leaky gut. But leaky gut is as stated in a 2015 published study in a journal of Frontiers in Immunology, it's the number one cause of mortality worldwide, leaky gut, because it's the number one driver of most chronic diseases that we know of. And so the stress is opening up, there's gaps in your intestinal lining and actually causing things to leak simply by just subtracting to your circulatory system. So this, I want people to have those two visuals and what stress is doing so that they really understand the importance of working on a reduction of that stress.
It's discounted like crazy. Believe me, it robs you of nutrients. It's so important. I appreciate you painting those visuals for us.
Yeah.
Okay, so we talked about birth and kind of all that big ecosystem, but we're talking about where we get our microbiota, and the bacteria evolves, right? And so when do we really get to where it's set and determined, and how does that change over time?
Yeah, so the microbiome initially, when you're first born and within the first 6 months, tends to be dominated by a few species. Most of the bacteria is one of those species. The moment you start introducing solid foods, which is usually around 6 months of age, we'll start seeing an increase in diversity of the microbiome. New species can start to crop up because now there's other sources of nutrients that can be consumed by different bacteria within the gut. So we'll start to see an increase in diversity of the microbiome right around 6 months. And that's good. That's what we want. And then over at the end of the first year, we're starting to get a glimpse of what your adult microbiome looks like. But after 1 year to 2.5 years is where we start seeing the biggest shift in the evolution of the microbiome. And right around 2.5 years of age is where you end up with what will be your adult-like microbiome. This becomes your unique signature of microbes that live in and on you that you will carry for the rest of your life. Now, for the next few years, you can make some slight changes to it. And that's typically dictated by the foods that the people eat, where they live, the amount of antibiotics that they're consuming or having to consume. And all of those things can shape the microbiome at that point. But for the most part, around 2.5 years, you start establishing your unique traits and your unique set of microorganisms. So essentially your ecosystem. And so that first 2.5 years becomes absolutely critical to minimizing the things that can really disrupt people's microbiomes. Then you really stay organic as much as you can, because anything that's not organic is loaded with glyphosate, for example. Minimizing the use of antibiotics, if you can. Minimizing processed foods that have a lot of preservatives in it. Certainly not using any personal care products on babies that age that have antibacterial, antimicrobial compounds in it. And then allowing the baby to get dirty. So the whole thing with a 1 year old, 2 year old is they go out, and if you let them play in nature, they'll go out there and they'll get in the dirt and they'll get dirty and they'll have fun. That's natural to them. They don't have the same view on dirt that we do as adults. And there's a reason for that, is because that dirt is extremely important in shaping that microbiome of theirs. So that kind of environmental exposure to natural environments and minimizing things that would hurt the microbiome becomes critical in that first 2.5 years of life.
Okay. So at first, babies inoculated with mom's bacteria. So moms, work on your bacteria now. And then about 2.5 years old is when the microbiome really, we're really evolving the bacteria until that time. And then it gets determined, right?
Yep, absolutely.
Okay. So that seems unfortunate, right? For all of us adults that are past 2.5 years. But let's talk about, there's a lot of things that can impact the microbiome, and I'm curious kind of about the length of how they impact it. But tell us how quickly the diet can change the microbiome environment.
Yeah, and that's the thing. We don't want to lose hope saying that we're over 2.5 years, so we can't make an impact. The good microbes are still there. So those of us that have dysbiotic guts, and we know that because we've got some condition we're working with, whether it's mood disorders or it's obesity or diabetes, whatever it may be, we know it's driven by a dysbiotic gut. But the good news is you can still make changes within your gut to affect that condition in a very positive way. As an example, you know, the difference between being obese and struggling with weight all the time versus being lean and being that kind of person that can eat what they want and never really gain weight, it was like a 3% shift in the ratio of bacteroidetes to firmicutes. When that smallest change can completely change your body composition. And these variables can be affected by diet. As you mentioned, diet can change your microbiome within a 24-hour period. You can have upwards of a 25-30% change in your microbiome. That's a 20 to 30 trillion organism change by just changing what you eat in a 1 day period.
I was just going to say, so when you eat healthy foods, you're going to crave, or your body's going to want healthier foods, right?
Absolutely. So most of your cravings and your likes and dislikes and foods and all that come from the type of bacteria you've been feeding. with the types of things we've been putting in your system. So if you're eating processed foods and a lot of sugars, you will more than likely crave more sugars and more processed foods, because those are the types of bacteria that are now proliferating within the gut, the ones that do really well in those sugars. And when they do well, then their whole clinic is that they're trying to perpetuate their own survival. So they will create neurotransmitters and all that they send to your brain to make you eat more of those types of foods. If you happen to do the hard thing and change your diet and cut out the sugars and all that for a period of time, it doesn't take long for your microbiome to change to a point where those cravings will go away and you demand healthier foods, because now you have bacteria that like those healthier foods and they encourage you to eat more healthy foods.
Yep, I see that all the time. So let's talk about how antibiotics affect the microbiome and how we can possibly rebound from them. I know you have some interesting stats about how they can wipe out some bacteria. Can you talk to that a little bit?
Yes, it was a couple of studies that have shown. For example, clindamycin is a very commonly used antibiotic for upper respiratory infections, sometimes for sinus infections, ear infections. So it's probably one of the more commonly used antibiotics, both in adults and probably kids as well. Study published, I think it was in 2015, showed that a single course of clindamycin, a 10-day course, which is a common course of the antibiotic, can take the microbiome over 2 years to recover. So for 2 years, you could have a disrupted microbiome. We also know that fluoroquinolone antibiotics, which have been used quite extensively over the last few years, because they are more powerful and we're developing more antibiotic-resistant strains. So they've gone to these new generation of fluoroquinolone antibiotics. They can disrupt your gut so much that one of the biggest side effects of fluoroquinolone antibiotics is anxiety and depression. So taking course antibiotics can then lead you to psychiatric issues. And then Augmentin, for example, is another broad-spectrum antibiotic that's used quite a bit for acute infections. A single dose of Augmentin at 650 milligrams can wipe down your microbiome by 90%. So imagine 90% of those 100 trillion bacteria get killed off with a single dose of the antibiotic. Now, they will bounce back, but what bounces back and in what proportion is where things get really disrupted.
Right.
So antibiotics have a huge impact. I don't want to demonize antibiotics. They are necessary in many cases. They will save lives. If I have bacterial meningitis and I'm really sick, I'm going to want the doctors to pump me full of antibiotics to save me. But there are things you should be doing. Again, if you have to be on antibiotics, there are some significant things you can do to reduce that recovery time from 2 years to as little as 4, 5, 6 weeks.
Like taking probiotics?
Yeah, exactly. You know, I said, would we just leave a cliffhanger there and don't tell them what they can do? But yes, taking probiotics. So the right kind of probiotics, the spore-based probiotics are really useful because they are stable in the presence of antibiotics. Not only are they stable in the presence of antibiotics, but they also do something called competitive exclusion. One of the biggest issues when you take antibiotics is it favors the reappearance of unfavorable organisms, like Clostridia, for example, or Enterococcus. These types of bacteria get to bounce back faster than your good bacteria once the antibiotics have wiped down the population. So what happens is the new resulting microbiome has too much of the bad bacteria. One of the things that those spore-based probiotics do is they have the ability to go in, find those overgrown with bad bacteria, and actually directly kill them and bring them down. And then they produce prebiotics inside the gut to regrow your good bacteria. As you're causing this decimation of your garden, of your flora within your gut, the spores are acting as a gardener and going in and continuously pulling out the weeds, retilling the soil, and re-supporting the growth of the good bacteria. So they're doing that actively in the presence of antibiotics.
I love a great analogy. A gardener, because that's incredible that they could even do that much. That's shocking. That's not something you would say about other probiotics, honestly.
Absolutely. They're the only ones that we've seen that have that kind of effect, where you think of your gut as a garden and you've got thousands of these plants, some of them good, some of them bad, and you're affecting your garden on a daily basis by putting chemicals in the soil. And then every time you add chemicals or there's acid rain, it kills off some of the good plants and weeds start to grow in their absence. What you're doing with the vast majority of probiotics is you're standing on the side of that garden and throwing in seeds. And you're hoping those seeds survive the process of flying into the garden through the acid wash, which is your stomach. and then getting into the soil and somehow embedding in the soil and then somehow outgrowing the weeds that are already there. That's what typical probiotics are. But the spores are the whole analogies. Instead of standing on the side and throwing in a bunch of seeds and hoping for the best, you're actually sending in an intelligent gardener that can identify the weeds, pull them out, grow the good plants. Now, the other probiotic that can be very useful in addition to the spores during antibiotics is Saccharomyces boulardii. So Saccharomyces boulardii is a yeast-based probiotic. It's completely stable in antibiotic, during antibiotic use. It doesn't really colonize, but one of the things that it does when it's moving through your system is it produces a lot of lactic acid and it re-acidifies your system. So one of the problems that happens with antibiotics that totally throws off the ecology is the antibiotics kill off a lot of the lactic acid producing bacteria. And when the lactic acid producing bacteria get killed off, the pH of the gut goes up. So the acidity goes up, which means the pH goes up. When the pH goes up, it favors the growth of candida, it favors the growth of E. coli, of Clostridia, all these other microorganisms that do better in a higher pH environment. That's part of what drives the ecological destruction. When you put the Saccharomyces in there, it produces all of this lactic acid as it's moving through your gut. So it continues to keep the pH low and more acidic, so that it's harder for those bad bacteria to show up instead.
I haven't been giving S. boulardii enough lip service or credit when I tell people. I'm just like, this is an antifungal one. So it was just so That's awesome. One other thing, as we talked, we put that big flag in about supporting yourself when you know you have times of stress. So we're talking about supporting after antibiotics or recovering. If it takes a couple of years, we want to speed that process up. We want to be always working on our immune system because when we get knocked down, it can get worse and worse. But an interesting thing I heard from you in one of your talks is that when someone else is in the house has a negative microbiome or maybe on antibiotics, it impacts the rest of the people in the house as well, right?
Yeah, that was a very fascinating study that was, I think, being done at Johns Hopkins by an MD, PhD who was researching in the microbiome. He presented that data at a microbiome congress where I was speaking as well. And I was fortunate enough to be speaking there because this data was absolutely fascinating. What he was able to show is if you take a household and you had one person in the household taking antibiotics for some reason, clearly that person's microbiome gets disrupted quite significantly. And he measured the microbiome disruption up to, I think it was 6 or 8 weeks after the course of antibiotics was stopped. So he was able to show that during the course of antibiotics, the microbiome was disrupted, and then that disruption lasted for at least 6 to 8 weeks afterwards. So he didn't go any further in the study, but what he wanted to show was that disruption lasts even after the antibiotics are done. But the most interesting thing is he also studied the microbiome of the people that live in the same household that were not taking the antibiotics. And he showed that their microbiomes got disrupted in the same manner as a person that was taking the antibiotics just by living in close proximity to that person. And what was even fascinating is he distinguished between people who are platonic and people who were actually in a relationship together. So it didn't seem to matter if you were just a roommate and you weren't intimate with the person, or if you were intimate with a person sleeping in the same bed, for example, none of that matters. If you were in the same household and you suffered the same destruction.
Interesting.
And that's really fascinating. Now, that brings up a couple of really important things to keep in mind. One is moms, for example. Moms were so dedicated to their children and the health and well-being of their children. They give so much of themselves to taking care of their kids on a daily basis, especially when their kids are sick and if their kids are going through a course of antibiotics and all that. But what mom needs to realize is, as the child is sick and the child is taking that antibiotic and you're giving the child all the things you can try to give them to make them better, your immune system and your microbiome is being destroyed as well for two reasons. One is because that universal antibiotic effect that we just mentioned, but the other thing is the stress. And there's nothing more stressful than seeing the child sick. And those two things become so significant in hurting mom's microbiome and her immune system. And of course, dad and anyone else that's taking care of a child. So it becomes really important that when your child gets ill, that you're taking extra care of yourself to make sure that you are remaining healthy as well, because you are getting this inadvertent destruction of your gut as well. And then people who are healthcare workers. If you work in the hospital, you work in the doctor's office, you are surrounded by people who are on chronic antibiotics. And that seems to have a destructive effect. That was one of the purposes of his study, was looking at the impact on doctors and nurses and people that work within hospitals and what's happening to their guts on a daily basis because they are surrounded by people who are on antibiotics chronically.
One of my favorite Quran quotes ever was, if only we could all have a giant vagina to go through every time we get sick.
And in the most innocent, nerdy way, I imagine that all the time, like, if we could just be reborn to this amazing, healthy vaginal canal over and over again, we'd all be totally fine because there's nothing more life-giving and supportive of wellness than vaginal canal. That's where life really starts. If you think about it, what's happening in the womb is the construction of the shell, right? That's the baby. That's the human facets of it, the organ systems, the brain and all that. What really gives the baby life is the bacteria that mom inoculates the baby with. That's the spark, right? So if we imagine if we're an engine and we're ready to turn on the engine, the spark plug starts the whole combustion effect that gives the engine life and makes it purr and breathe and produce power. The spark of life comes from mom's vaginal canal that inoculates that shell. And until that shell gets inoculated properly, it's not really functioning as a human. And that's what we've come to understand about the bio.
You know, in 2020, that'll be your project, trying to replicate that in some fashion. And it will seem really weird, but we're doing all kinds of crazy things.
Exactly. And I've done it in my head 1,000 times. I've already created this amazing tiny vagina for us in my head. So it's just about putting plans to paper and getting them.
It could be like a slide, really. So it wouldn't be weird. It could be fun if you just ignore some thoughts. So let's get some applicable or practical use questions out of the way.
Yeah.
How long do you think it takes for a probiotic to take effect? And I want to qualify that a little bit more so you can roll with that question a bit. So do you think that people should be cycling or changing strains? Because if your microbiome is as diverse as a rainforest, should you really be pigeonholing yourself with 2 strains? At least that's been the discussion with traditional probiotics. And then do you feel that people should be on probiotic forever, long term? Does the body come to rely on that bacteria that's been giving prophylactically or orally?
Yeah, so 2 very good and important questions, actually. Let's talk about the first one about diversity. One thing we do know with a great deal of certainty is that a diverse microbiome is the healthiest form of the microbiome. There's been all of these studies on the microbiome and comparing the microbiome of different populations, sick people, healthy people that live in rainforests, people that live in urban areas. And the conclusion is diversity in the microbiome makes you healthy. You actually live significantly longer if you have a diverse microbiome. Your risk for numerous diseases are much more reduced with a diverse microbiome. So the whole goal here is to increase the diversity of the microbiome. So let's talk about probiotics and increasing the diversity of the microbiome. It was presumed that you can increase the diversity of the microbiome by taking a probiotic that has a lot of strains in it, or that has all this shifting around and cycling through probiotics to get yourself some increase in diversity. Well, now when we really understand how the microbiome works and functions, now that doesn't work at all. So think about a probiotic that has, let's say, 20 strains in it, right? There's not even the probiotics that have 20 strains. The average probiotic has somewhere around 7 to 9 strains in it. But let's take one that we would consider to be a super diverse probiotic that has 20 strains. Even if all of those strains are actually surviving through the gastric system, which with most probiotics, they actually don't even survive through the stomach acid. But let's presume they survive, and let's presume they survive the small intestine, and they actually get into the largest part of the microbial population, which is the large intestine. 20 strains getting in and being added to a microbiome that has over 1,500 strains is a very small impact on the diversity of the microbiome. And the concentration is also very small. Most of these probiotic products will have, let's say, 50 billion CFUs. Now, 50 billion sounds like a lot, but when you put it in context of 100 trillion bacteria that are in the gut, 50 billion is like trying to change the color of the ocean by putting a single drop of dye in it. Mm. It's nothing compared to the size and scope of the microbiome. So there is no way of making a diversity change in the microbiome by trying to add more strains at higher doses. And they realize this because they've been studying this in the case of C. diff, right? So C. diff is an opportunistic infection that occurs when you're immunosuppressed and you take a course of antibiotics. C. diff takes over the microbiome and cause a significant amount of diarrhea and illness. Now, C. diff is typically controlled by, in most healthy people, by a diverse microbiome. So C. diff is always there. It's not a bacteria that comes in from outside and causes infection. It's always there, but when your microbiome gets decimated, when the diversity of the microbiome shrinks, C. diff has a chance to take over and cause disease. So hospitals and doctors have been studying how do we control C. diff with the probiotics. So they've been giving people oral probiotics that have 300 billion, 500 billion CSUs, 15 strains, 25 strains, to see if they can control C. diff. And what they've come up with is they have not been able to have a single measurable impact on C. diff by utilizing lots of strains and high doses. And which means that that those types of probiotics are not changing the microbiome in any measurable way. The biggest reason is most of those strains don't even survive through the gastric system. So when you take them, they're getting killed off in the acid of the stomach, and they're just basically pooping out dead bacteria. What they've had to do is go to fecal transplants. So that's where fecal transplants came from, because they realized that they can't get enough strains of bacteria and high enough concentration of bacteria through the oral route to make any measurable change within the microbiome. So what we're going to have to do is take someone's fecal matter, which has trillions of bacteria, and then send it up the mouth, because then it avoids the acid wash of the stomach and the small intestines and all that. So that is significant evidence that you cannot change and impact the diversity by just trying to take probiotics that have a lot of strains in it and high concentrations. Now, well, we have shown, we're actually going to be publishing a study probably in March of next year, is with the spore-based probiotics, just taking five strains, increases the diversity of the microbiome by over 20 trillion organisms. Then the question becomes, well, how in the world does five strains actually increase the diversity, right? Again, keep in mind that these are the gardeners, right? So what they're doing is actually going in and completely reconditioning the gut. So they're going in and they're detoxifying the gut. They are actually directly suppressing the growth of overgrown bacteria, of unfavorable bacteria, and then also producing probiotics to regrow the good bacteria. So these guys actually have the ability to go in, rule the microbial environment, that fancy word for that is called quorum sensing, and then figure out where there's less diversity, where there's overgrown organisms, and they can actually fix that by killing off bad bacteria and increasing good bacteria. So we saw this huge amount of increase in microbial diversity within the microbiome by just adding in these gardeners. This is the spores. So if we're going to increase diversity by probiotics, so far the spores are the only ones that have ever been shown to be able to increase diversity within the microbiome. The second part of your question about getting used to it, we were concerned about that too, because there was a study that's being worked on at the American Gut Project. And what they were studying is they're looking at Crohn's and colitis, these inflammatory bowel conditions, because the prevalence of these conditions go through the roof. And what they are doing is actually characterizing the gut of people that have Crohn's and colitis compared to healthy people that don't have those conditions. And they were looking for differences between the microbiomes. What they were able to find is the one measurable difference that was quite prevalent was that people with Crohn's tended to have an overgrowth of Lactobacillus acidophilus. And Lactobacillus acidophilus happens to be the number one selling probiotic strain in the U.S. in the probiotic industry. It's found in most yogurts and fermented products. It's also found in virtually every probiotic on the market. Now, we don't have enough data to say that the probiotics are causing this condition because of the overbuild and overexposure of the strains, but there's certainly correlated data to show that too much of any one strain could be a problem. And so with that in mind, what we did is we said, okay, where did our ancestors get the probiotics from? So that we know that we were looking at sources that humans were continuously exposed to on a daily basis, and that's where the environment comes in. So our ancestors were hunters and gatherers, they were foragers, they ate dope, they drank waters out of rivers and streams, they got huge amounts of exposure to environmental bacteria, and some of these environmental bacteria developed the capability of getting into the system, getting past the stomach acid, and actually going and living in the gut. What's beautiful about what they've done through the course of evolution is these strains have made themselves semi-transient. They live in the gut for right around 3 weeks and then they leave. And they leave in particular because if they don't leave, then at some point they would overpopulate the environment. So they've created this limitation on themselves so that you could still get the benefits of the daily exposure for them, stimulating the immune system, helping you digest your food, producing short-chain fatty acids, sealing up the leaky gut, doing the gardener work in your microbiome. And then at some point they lose so that then they don't overpopulate. So there's a self-regulatory mechanism there. With other conventional probiotics, the studies done at American Gut seems to show that maybe there is a risk of overexposure to those particular strains.
There is. It's just odd. It's like they have their own brain, right? And they're this master intelligent garden, just the way they're working. I don't think people listening necessarily, I think maybe media has made us think that probiotics heal gut permeability issues. They do not on that line, right? Until we're talking about this spore-based and from what you found in your studies. And so just that is quite jaw-dropping for me. So I'm taking the challenge. I'm going to start putting everyone on it. And we're going to track and look at the data as well for fun, right? Because we're all...
Absolutely.
But here's a big question. So we're talking about looking at where our ancestors got probiotics. So it sounds like we're talking about dirt-based. Can you clarify the difference between dirt-based and spore-based probiotics?
Yeah, that's really important because what I hear a lot is people assume that all soil-based organisms are spores. That's not true. Most soil-based organisms live in the soil, function in the soil. Their whole job is to turn over the soil. They break down plant matter. They break down carcasses of dying organisms. They fix nitrogen. Their whole function is in the soil. Most soil organisms don't really do anything as a probiotic within your gut. They, if you're exposed to them, they pass through. During the passage, they can upregulate some aspects of the immune system, which is good for you. And then they move right out. And a lot of them also die in the gastric system. The spore-based organisms are sitting in the soil in the spore form, waiting to get consumed because their natural home is the gut. Their natural home is not the soil. It's actually the gut. They're actually part of the commensal flora, but you gain exposure to them in the outside environment rather than lungs, vaginal canal. And that's the big difference. If you see a product that's a soil-based organism product, it's typically organisms that are just grabbed from the soil, and most of them aren't really going to function as probiotics. They're not harmful in any way. Some of them can actually be beneficial, but they don't form spores. So most of them will die going to the gastric system and they won't really colonize in the gut. What we've done is focus specifically on the spore-forming organisms within soil that have the capability of surviving through the gut, and then actually colonizing and living in the digestive tract and creating all these changes. So what you need to look for when you're looking for a spore-based product is you need to look for Bacillus endospores, so things, strains like Bacillus subtilis, Bacillus clausi, Bacillus coagulans. These Bacillus organisms are the true spore-based organisms, and typically the product should say spore organisms on it somewhere. So they distinguish between just soil organisms and soil and spore-based organisms.
Okay. There's a lot to take in there, quite a bit.
Yes.
I'm just scanning some of my notes there. Other probiotics, I just want to differentiate. So we talked spore versus soil. They're not quite the same. Spores are there waiting. It makes me wonder. So I have some really complex, really chronically ill people, just really rough, not on life support with dialysis and whatnot. And I see a lot of pica, right? So that's craving and food items and craving a dirt. And just, and usually I consider that kind of a mineral deficiency, but makes me curious about what else that could possibly mean. Like our body innately knows things if we would listen to it sometimes. So it's just a curiosity. But so spore versus soil based. But then just for context, other types of probiotics are generally derived from animal or human sources. Is that correct?
Yeah, exactly. They're usually isolated from fecal matter in healthy human volunteers or animals, and then they're cultured on dairy to grow them up, and then they're dried and turned into a powder.
And their survival mechanism is generally the capsule. There's a couple strains that do survive stomach acid without, I think, Bacillus coagulans, but generally that's their survival mechanism. Whereas the big differentiator is with spore-based is that they're so hardy. And they don't, they're just not killed. They're shelf-stable, et cetera. There are other, there's conventional, or I don't even know how to refer to them, spore-based and non-spore-based. What do you use?
Yeah, I just call them conventional probiotics, which are your typical lactobacillus strains, your bifidobacteria strains, streptococcus, and all these other things that are utilized in most conventional probiotics. And like you said, the way companies try to get them to survive through the gastric system is by the encapsulation process or tableting process where they add special coatings and all that. And to me, I'm a microbiologist and I follow the science very closely in anything I do or recommend. But I also have a side of me that's very much an evolutionary biologist. And I also believe that in nutritional therapy, what we should be doing for the most part is doing things that we are supposed to be getting exposed to in a natural habitat that we inadvertently don't because of our modern lifestyle, right? And so when I see a company that's taking a strain and it's adding all of this technology to the strain to try to get it to survive our natural digestive system, it indicates to me that strain is not meant to be used as a probiotic, right? Nature did not create it to be a probiotic when you have to engineer it to try to do a function. That's the pharmaceutical model to me. The pharmaceutical model is all about trying to re-engineer our biology, interfering with normal biological processes or putting them on a tangent in another way, stopping something, stimulating something in an artificial way. And that's really kind of how most of these probiotics are being developed. I wanted to go back and look right at nature and say, where would our ancestors get us probiotics? And which one of these strains that our ancestors would have been exposed to has a natural capability to survive through the gastric system? Having that natural capability to survive through the gastric system, which is very rare for bacteria, indicates to me that nature intended this bacteria to be a probiotic. And as it turns out, when you focus on those organisms, they really do function as probiotics. They are the gardeners of your garden, and nature created them that way. And so this spore is its own microencapsulation. The bacteria puts this armor-like coating around itself to be able to survive through the harsh gastric environment, to be able to survive through the bile acids and bile salt to the upper GI, and then get to the site of action naturally. Once it gets to the site of action, it actually breaks out of the spore and goes to work for you as a functional probiotic.
Do you know how long that spore-based probiotics last in the gut? Well, how long do the benefits of probiotics last in the gut?
So each individual, the benefits can last for some time because they make a real fundamental change in the gut. As I mentioned, they completely change the microbiomes. Give you an example of that. One of the very, very important classes of bacteria in your gut is called Akkermansia. Akkermansia, especially mucinophilia, should make up in a healthy individual 5 to 10% of their microbiome. High levels of Akkermansia are associated with being lean, having very healthy metabolic systems, very low risk for heart disease, very low risk for diabetes, cancers, and so on. High levels of Akkermansia is indicative of a very healthy microbiome. One of the things we showed in a recent study is that when you add the spores, in a matter of 3 weeks, it dramatically increases the amount of Akkermansia in your body. So the spores have a way of increasing these other good bacteria. So those changes last for some time until the spores are gone away. So with their continuous influence, they're gone. Let's say you stop taking it. And then the glyphosates and other chemicals and all that we're continuously exposed to take hold. They can diminish the growth of Akkermansia once again. So what we say is the spores themselves last in your body for about 3 weeks. Every single dose you take hangs out for about 3 weeks. Their impact on your body can last longer depending on your lifestyle.
Interesting. So in terms of immunity, it would be beneficial to be taking these probiotics at least on occasion to help build that up prophylactically ahead of getting some kind of bug, right?
Absolutely. So now one of the most important aspects of your immune system is something called the Peyer's patches, which is found in the ileum of your small intestine. So that's the very end part of the small intestine. The Peyer's patches are the number one source of sampling for all the stuff that's coming into your body from your digestive tract, from your nasopharynx and all that. One of the things people don't realize is that there's something called a mucociliary elevator, right? So all the mucus that's in your chest, in your sinus cavities, and all those other areas that get exposed to viruses and bacteria on a regular basis, the mucus in that area captures those toxins and bacteria and viruses. And then the mucus is designed to move up and then through and then into your throat, right? So you're supposed to be able to like slurp up the mucus from the chest and all that and swallow it. So that mucociliary elevator is designed to take mucus that's full of bacteria and viruses that could infect you from all the upper respiratory system and cause you to swallow it. When you swallow it, what's happening is then that mucus goes in And it presents all of that stuff to your Peyer's patches in your small intestine. Then that gives your immune system a chance to learn what kind of viruses and bacteria we're continuously exposed to and build an immune defense system against it. Now, what we've shown through studies is the spores interact with that part of your immune system really effectively, and in fact increases the capability of your immune system to form a protective reaction against all of the viruses and bacteria that we're typically exposed to. So it's important to get that regular exposure to those spores. If so, no other reason is so that they interact with the Peyer's patches and enhance your capability of mounting an immune response to protect the body.
Okay, good. That's good practical things that people should know, that sometimes when you're trying to take a probiotic in the midst of an illness, it's, we always used to compare it to throwing a glass of water on a fire. I would agree with that analogy.
When you have all that mucus and all that stuff oozing through, that contains the bacteria that's making you ill. And swallowing that is actually a good thing. Most of us blow it out, like when we blow our noses and it's turned into a Kleenex or a napkin. But it's actually good to swallow that to some degree. And when you take the spores with it, then as your immune system is trying to fight off that bacterial virus, you're basically presenting which virus or bacteria it is that's causing the illness to your immune system. The spore are presented along with it, and the spores dramatically enhance the ability of the immune system to fight that off. So in an acute situation, if you have a cold right now, it becomes really important to swallow some of that mucus and then take some spores with it. It'll enhance the body's ability to fight that cold off.
I'm going to have a dietitian had a question for you about the long-term safety of spore-based probiotics. It sounds like they've been in use for a long time, right? They've been around forever.
Yeah, to give you an example, in the pharmaceutical industry, they've been around since 1952. They're some of the most widely used probiotics in Europe, Asia, Latin America, everywhere but the U.S. They were launched as a prescription drug in France and Germany in 1952. They have been prescription drugs in most of Europe, in Russia, in Southeast Asia for well over 60 years. So there's a lot of data on the safety of their use, long-term use, in the pharmaceutical industry where they actually collate this kind of data. Other than that, we also know that spores, these same spores, have been in the highly abundant in the natural environment for the last 3 to 5 million years, all throughout the course of human evolution. Our ancestors have been naturally exposed to these same strains and consuming them on a daily basis every time they ate food or drank something. So we've had a very long-term relationship with these particular organisms, hence their ability to get in and understand what our gut should look like. You know, they know better what a gut should look like than we do. You know, they have the ability to get in, read the gut environment and figure out what's wrong with it and then make adjustments to it.
I started studying probiotics in 2008 and you learned a lot today. This is just a really exciting, crazy, growing field. And this is just such a separate piece of it that I think is really going to take hold as more people start to understand what the difference is. Because honestly, it's just not understanding. We've been conditioned for so long about conventional probiotics, so much about them. And there's just some key differences about these spore-based. They're so much hardier. They'll survive the gastric, the stomach acid. I know you have some information about how conventional probiotics just really aren't even making it to the site, whereas spore-based definitely do. Just the way they act once they get in, being a master gardener, those are some of the key differences I've heard today about the benefits of spore probiotics maybe over conventional probiotics. Is there anything else to add to that?
Yeah, to me, the two biggest things and the reason why we focus on them so much is we were looking for a bacteria that had a universal effect on the body. When I say universal effect, fixing certain fundamental defaults that are associated with having a disrupted microbiome. Two of those things are the diversity in the microbiome. So what we were looking for is a bacteria that can actually enhance diversity of the microbiome. We've been able to show with our studies that these spores do. No other probiotics have ever published any studies or produced any studies to show that. Then the second part is a probiotic that can actually heal leaky gut. Leaky gut, again, being the number one driver of most chronic diseases, being able to heal leaky gut has a significant impact on health and wellness in general. We published the very first study in August of this year of a probiotic actually healing leaky gut. In fact, we published our study in the World Journal of Gastrointestinal Pathophysiology. It's a straight up GI doctor journal where they hardly ever talk about probiotics or anything natural within the gut, but they were so interested in having us publish this study in their journal because they saw it as a frontier paper because nothing's ever been shown to be this effect. Just the ability of this force to increase diversity and see a leaky gut, to me, is so significantly impactful in health and wellness. And that's throughout the whole spectrum of diseases that we're trying to deal with.
It's a really big deal. I talk to her all the time about how when they just throw a random probiotic at whatever condition, like, what's like step four in the process, right? I don't need to add that. So just this idea, and now I'm excited to experiment with it, because as much as I'm speaking to the condition, IBS or eczema or whatever, what we're really always doing is working on gut.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's the same structure in the gut. When we were speaking earlier, I mentioned that it would take, let's say, two diseases that couldn't be more opposite. Take acne as a disease and take Parkinson's as a disease, right? One affects younger people. It's typically cosmetic. It's not life-threatening, but it's a really annoying condition that has huge impact on people's social lives. And then Parkinson's, which is considered to be a incurable degenerative disease that typically affects old people. Imagine that both of those have the same starting mechanism. They're driven by the same thing, but they manifest completely differently and in different parts of life. Both of those start with hyperpermeability of the intestines, LPS endotoxins from the gut leaking into the circulatory system and then causing the immune activation either in the brain in the case of Parkinson's or in the skin and the capillary beds in the skin in the case of acne. But there's such different diseases with the same driving force. And so our focus has been, how can we stop that universal driving force of many of these conditions?
So despite their shelf stability, I feel like spore probiotics aren't necessarily easy to find. Can you tell us about where we can find these probiotics?
Yeah, when we first started investigating this, we realized that these spores are extremely important and are probably the next generation of highly effective probiotics. We searched the U.S. market and we found no real spore probiotics, especially not a multi-spore probiotic with more than one strain in it. So we had to create one. So we developed one, a product called the Spore Biotic. And that's the one that we've done all our clinical trials with. That's the one that we're doing our current six clinical trials with. It's called Megaspore Biotic. It's got five strains in it. It's typically sold only through practitioners. We don't sell it in retail and so on. The practitioners like yourself can offer it to your patients.
Right. There's a couple strains here. I'm holding the bottle and looking at it. There's a couple strains for sure that are patented specifically for your company only. So you'll be the only one that has those strains.
Yeah, actually, four out of the five strains are we have a global exclusive on. We work with Royal Holloway London University to obtain these strains. When we decided, okay, we wanted to do our own spore-based probiotic because we didn't find any in the marketplace, we went right to an academic institute to get access to strains because nobody studies strains better than an academic institute because they look at it purely from a scientific academic standpoint. They get into every aspect of the genetics of the strain, the proteomics, which means the types of proteins the strain produces. So they studied these strains inside out and knew virtually everything about it. And so we went to them and globally licensed these strains specifically for creating this particular product. So it's only in this product that you'll find these strains that have been shown to increase the diversity, see a leaky gut, and all the things we've been talking about.
Thank you for going to gather those up and deliver them to us. This is so nice of you.
Well, the crazy thing about it is the vast majority of my career, I've been behind the scenes doing research. I had a clinical research company that I started where I was doing contract clinical research work for nutritional companies, helping companies develop products and so on. Never would I think would I have a product of my own in the marketplace at any point in my career. And so this came purely out of need. I got into the probiotic industry because my research company was hired by a large multinational brand company to study probiotics and to recommend to them what types of strains would be the next generation of probiotics. So through our research work, we came up with these spores and we went to them and said, hey, these are the real strains. This is what nature has created as probiotics for us. Nobody's using these. You've got to create a product with this. And the fortunate thing now in retrospect is that when we went back to them with this recommendation, they had just got bought out by a much larger entity. And they said, we're not doing any new products right now. We're tabling all of that. We're going through all this reorganization. And I thought to myself, this is so important. I've got to just make a leap and produce a product myself. So this is the first and only product that I've produced as my own that I put my stamp on. And it took us over 5 years to develop it, to really study the strains, formulate it correctly, figure out the right dosing, how to use it, and so on. And then after day one of launching the product, our focus has been spending at least 5 times more on clinical trials than we do on marketing. And that's exactly the opposite of every other company in the supplement world. Every company in the supplement world spends a lot on marketing, virtually nothing on clinical studies. And so that's the big difference here. So we're very proud of the product that we've seen huge amounts of differences. We've got almost 10,000 doctors in the U.S. that use it. We're now in 9 other countries, and there's thousands of doctors all over the world that use it. We're completing 5 new clinical trials. So it's super exciting to see what it can actually do. And I'm always very grateful for the Oxygen to be able to talk about it and just talk about gut health as well. Thank you so much for giving me this opportunity, because I think it's so important to get this stuff into people.
I can tell you're a natural. Like, it's just your passion. I bet you jump out of bed like this every day.
I do a jump on angle spores.
And you think about that slide you're going to make, and it's just...
Oh my God, that's a fantasy, yes. The jump slide.
As someone who's worked in industry as well, usually you don't see that research and the product always connect or marry so beautifully. So the fact that you're doing all that research on the back end will make your marketing effortless eventually. But that's my biggest complaint about spore-based probiotics right now, is I don't know enough about them. So thank you for letting me share this with my audience, for sure.
Absolutely. It's been a pleasure.
Sharing and reviewing this podcast is the best way to help us succeed with our mission to help integrate the best of East and West and empower you to raise the bar on your health story. Just go to reviewthispodcast.com/less-stressed-life. That's reviewthispodcast.com/less-stressed-life, and you'll be taken directly to a page where you can insert your review and hit post.